Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are here to shortcut your reading list, taking the most technical, dense source material and extracting the breakthroughs that truly matter.
Right. And today we are putting on our protective eyewear and plunging deep into material science, specifically metallurgy.
Our focus today is on this relentless quest for perfect material performance.
And our source is a fantastic deep cut. It's a 1982 PhD dissertation from the University of Cambridge, authored by Mark Jolly. It's titled Rapid Solidification of Tin-Based Alloys.
A dissertation from 82, that is absolutely our kind of archaeology.
It is. So our mission is pretty straightforward, but scientifically, it's quite challenging. We're performing a deep dive to extract the crucial knowledge about how extreme cooling can change a metal at a truly fundamental level.
And we really want to know what this research tells us about improving a component that's ancient but still vital. The plain bearing.
Exactly.
And when you say extreme cooling, you really mean extreme.
Oh, absolutely. The techniques here achieve cooling rates as high as, what, 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 10 kelvins per second?
I mean, that's a number that doesn't even compute. To give you some context, that's not just fast. It's a speed that lets scientists basically hit the pause button on atomic physics.
You're forcing the metal to freeze before it can settle into its comfortable thermodynamic state. You're actively defying the normal laws of equilibrium metallurgy.
So it's less like freezing and more like, what, instantaneous molecular capture?
That's a great way to put it. I mean, think of it this way. If you flash freeze a bowl of soup that fast, the ice crystals have no time to grow. The vegetables don't have time to sink.
You just lock everything in place.
You lock everything in place. You create this highly unstable, non-equilibrium structure that just shouldn't exist. And that instability is precisely what gives us superior performance.
Okay, let's unpack that. Let's first establish the problem that this really radical science is trying to solve, the humble plain bearing.
It's so easy to overlook, but the bearing is, I mean, it's one of the absolute pillars of industrial tech. It allows a shaft to rotate inside a housing with minimal friction.
And they go way back.
Oh, way back.
Right.
The earliest concepts are something like 5,000 years old.
5,000 years. That's incredible. That's a technology that predates Roman concrete.
It does. The research points to examples like pivot bearings in Egyptian chariots, which are 3,400 years old. And of course, Leonardo da Vinci's designs in the Codex Madrid I. This stuff is fundamental to civilization.
So fast forward to the modern era. Tin-based alloys, often called Babbitt metals, are still crucial for these bearings. Why tin?
Well, tin alloys, you know, mixed with antimony, zinc, copper,
yeah,
they have this rare combination of properties you need. But the conventional way of making them, standard casting, you run into huge limitations.
And what does standard casting do that's so bad for the material?
It's just too slow. That slow cooling lets the grains in the metal grow really large, and more importantly, it causes segregation.
Right, so the different elements separate out, like the heavy chocolate chips sinking to the bottom of the cake batter.
That's a perfect analogy. And this segregation creates weak points. So under the constant stress of high-load machinery, those weak points, they just can't handle it. The fatigue resistance is terrible.
And fatigue is really the main killer, the constant flexing and breaking.
It's the main limiting factor in modern engineering, for sure.
So if the fatigue limit is the problem, you think, okay, you just need an alloy with extremely high strength. But this is the paradox, isn't it? A bearing material has to be strong, but it also has to be soft.
That is the engineering conflict right there. You need the bulk of the material to be incredibly strong to take the load and resist fatigue. But the surface needs these other properties, like embeddability and conformity.
Okay, define those for us.
So embeddability is the material's ability to absorb small pieces of debris. Think microscopic bits of dirt or metal in the oil. The bearing needs to just swallow them up so they don't score and destroy the rotating shaft.
It embeds the particle safely.
Right. And conformity is the ability of the material to just slightly deform, to flow and match any tiny imperfections or misalignments in the shaft while it's running.
So you need a material that can withstand tons of pressure, but also be soft enough to accept debris and adjust on the fly. You need strength and forgiveness at the same time.
Which sounds impossible if you're playing by the traditional rules of metallurgy.
And that's why we have to cheat.
Exactly. Which is where rapid solidification, or RS, comes in. RS is our chance to cheat.
Okay, let's get into the four major ways this extreme cooling restructures the alloy. The first one, and it's sort of the most basic, is grain refinement.
Right, because the metal is cooled in milliseconds. The crystals just don't have time to grow large. you end up with these extremely fine grain sizes, just a few micrometers across.
And the practical effect of that is dictated by something called the Hall-Petch relationship. Don't let that term scare you, listener. Let's translate Hall-Petch.
It's actually pretty simple. The internal crystal walls in the metal, the grain boundaries, they act like tiny speed bumps for stress. So when the material is under load, that stress tries to travel through it. But with drastically smaller grains, you have way more speed bumps. So the material becomes exponentially stronger.
More speed bumps, harder to deform.
Got it. Okay, the second effect is where the cheating gets really good. Extended solid solubility or supersaturation.
And this sounds like what it is. You're forcing atoms into a space they really don't want to be.
I see.
Under normal cooling, an alloy has a fixed limit on how much of a secondary element you can dissolve into the main metal. The rest just precipitates out.
Like trying to dissolve too much sugar in cold water, eventually it just sinks to the bottom.
Exactly like that. For these tin antimony alloys, the normal limit for antimony is about 3.8%. But with rapid solidification, they achieved. Get this. 15 to 20% antimony held in the solution.
Whoa, that's 5 times the normal limit.
5 times, and all that excess antimony acts like this powerful internal stiffener. It just fundamentally changes how the tin behaves.
And the third effect directly attacks that original flaw from casting the segregation. Right, since the freezing is almost instant, the atoms literally don't have time to move. They can't diffuse away.
So no separation.
No separation. It minimizes that microsegregation, creating what's a kind of a self-homogenization. Every atom is frozen right where it was. You get perfect uniformity.
And the final effect is creating these exotic internal structures.
Correct. RS can create what are called metastable phases, crystal structures that are only stable under these extreme conditions. Sometimes you can get amorphous structures or metallic glasses.
Okay.
And crucially, it also introduces a high density of internal imperfections, lattice defects, vacancies. And these little defects are actually essential for improving hardening processes later on.
So let's recap. We have a structure that is ultra fine-grained, chemically uniform, and massively supersaturated. What's the payoff for strength and creep resistance?
Well, the fine grain size and that supersaturated solution, they both work together to resist the movement of imperfections inside the material, which are known as dislocations.
Wait, pause there. Dislocations sound bad. Hmm. What are they actually doing inside the metal that fine grains can stop?
Okay, think of a big rug that's too heavy to drag across a floor.
Okay.
You don't pick up the whole thing. You move a wrinkle across it, right? That wrinkle is a dislocation. Metal doesn't move all its atoms at once. It moves these atomic scale wrinkles through its structure.
And the RS structure is so dense and finely knit
that it just drastically impedes the movement of those wrinkles.
I get it. So by stopping the wrinkles, you stop the metal from deforming under a long-term load, which is creep resistance.
Precisely. Creep is that tendency to slowly deform under constant stress, even stress that's below its normal yield strength. And in a bearing, creep resistance is absolutely non-negotiable.
So the net result of all this is a material with way better strength and creep resistance, finally solving the fatigue problem of old Babbitt metal.
That is the goal of the entire project, yes.
Okay, that enhanced strength sounds amazing. But as always, the how is where the engineering nightmare really begins. You can't get 1,000,000 kelvins per second in cooling just by pouring hot metal onto a cold plate.
No, you cannot.
So what was the mechanism they used to pull this off?
The technique they chose is called melt spinning. At the time of this research, it was really the most convenient method available to continuously produce these ribbons of material that were thin enough to cool that fast.
Describe the apparatus for us. Give us the visceral picture.
Okay, imagine a massive solid brass wheel, about 9 inches in diameter. This wheel is the chill substrate, and it's spinning at insane speeds, up to 33 meters per second at the edge.
That's over 70 miles per hour.
Right. And above this wheel, you have a crucible of molten metal. And then, using high-pressure argon gas, you shoot a tiny jet of that metal straight onto the surface of the spinning wheel.
So you've got a jet of liquid metal hitting a surface moving at highway speeds. The contact time must be almost nothing.
It is. But just getting that metal out cleanly was the first huge hurdle. The crucible, the pot holding the metal, it caused so many problems.
What went wrong?
Early versions were made of graphite, and they just oxidize at high temperatures. Or worse, they just lack the strength to handle the high gas pressure. They would. Well, they'd fail spectacularly.
So they were fighting the container just to get the metal out.
Constantly. The final design that worked was a much tougher stainless steel crucible that had replaceable nozzle plates. That was key, because it let them swap out the tiny orifice without having to rebuild the whole thing every time.
Now, once that metal jet hits the wheel, it flash freezes into this fragile ribbon.
Yes.
You're talking about something only tens of micrometers thick, right? Thinner than air. Controlling those dimensions must be nearly impossible.
It's unbelievably sensitive. The final width and thickness are affected by, I think, 9 different interconnected factors. Yeah. You have the obvious ones, like the nozzle size and the gas pressure, but also the melt's viscosity, the exact temperature of the metal, the wheel speed. If any one of those shifts just a little bit, the quality of the ribbon is ruined.
How do you even begin to control 9 things at once?
You have to rely on modeling. The research used a lot of theoretical analysis based on models from guys like Lieberman and Kavesh to try and predict the ribbon dimensions.
And what was the key finding there?
The core finding, and it makes sense, is that the thickness of the ribbon is inversely proportional to the substrate speed. The faster the wheel spins, the more that molten jet gets stretched and the thinner the product is.
Okay, that's the elegant theory. But scaling this up means you have to confront the messy reality of fluid dynamics.
And that is the real villain of this story, the instability problem. The stability of that molten jet is what fundamentally limits the quality of your ribbon. Well, first, you need enough pressure just to overcome surface tension. It acts like a skin trying to hold the metal inside the nozzle. For their setup, you needed a minimum velocity of about 1 meter per second. Just to push the liquid out.
And once you get it out, you have to worry about turbulence. You mentioned the Reynolds number earlier. How turbulent was this?
Oh, it was wildly turbulent. The Reynolds number they calculated for the tin jet was between 7,700 and 19,000.
And in fluid dynamics, anything above about 2,000 is considered turbulent, right?
That's right. So this jet of liquid metal was inherently chaotic from the start.
Wait, how did they produce any usable ribbon if the flow was that chaotic? Wouldn't it just splatter everywhere?
It would if the flight path was long.
Yeah.
But the key is the extremely short distance to the wheel and the high pressure forcing it forward. But that turbulence still creates instabilities, which they actually documented using high-speed photography with water models. It's brilliant.
And what were the main instabilities they saw?
2 main things. First, simple capillary waves, just ripples on the liquid stream itself. But the other, more interesting one, was related to the spinning wheel. It's called the gas boundary layer.
The cushion of air being dragged along by the wheel.
Exactly. That wheel is spinning at 70 miles an hour. It's dragging the air with it, creating this high-speed cushion of gas. If the wheel speed gets too high, that gas layer itself becomes unstable and turbulent.
And when that happens?
The turbulent air literally tears at the edges of the ribbon as it's freezing.
And that tearing shows up as a physical defect on the final product.
Yes. They're called fir tree edges, or serration. It looks like the edge of the ribbon has been shredded by the unstable airflow.
So they solved the single jet problem, or at least they understand its limits, only to face new problems when they try to scale up with multiple jets to make wider ribbons.
That's always the way, isn't it? Producing a wider ribbon means using multiple jets side by side and just hoping they merge perfectly.
But they don't.
Not always. The water modeling showed this really specific, undesirable problem they called the shark's fin defect. It's where the molten metal would pile up between the jets, creating this ridge down the middle of the sheet. It would make the final product completely unusable. The control you need is just phenomenal.
That is a phenomenal look at the real-world fight in materials engineering. You're trying to harness chaotic physics to get perfect results. So let's synthesize this. What are the central takeaways from this deep dive into 1982 research?
The central finding, I think, is that we can fundamentally restructure materials using extreme physics. Rapidly pulling the heat out creates this highly desirable non-equilibrium state. You get massive supersaturation, drastically fine grain size.
And that delivers the enhanced strength and creep resistance you need for a better bearing.
Precisely.
So the implication is clear. Rapid solidification gives you a real pass to making superior tin antimony alloys that finally overcome the fatigue limits that have plagued Babbitt metal for, well, for decades.
It's a huge technological leap. And it's all driven by just meticulous measurement and observation. The perfect alloy is possible, but only if you can beat the constraints of fluid dynamics and high-speed engineering.
And that brings us to the final provocative thought. The success we've talked about relies completely on creating these perfect exotic ribbons and flakes that are only tens of micrometers thick.
Right. Incredibly fragile.
To be useful as a bearing, that fragile ribbon has to be consolidated into a solid high-integrity rod or ring. And that process involves violent actions like high pressure compression and extrusion. You're basically squishing the ribbons together and forcing them through a die.
Yes, it's a process that involves both high heat and immense mechanical force.
So the question for you to consider is this: how much of that hard-won, exotic, non-equilibrium microstructure, that delicate balance of supersaturation and ultra-fine grains that you achieved by flash freezing, how much of it actually survives the violent process of turning the ribbon into a solid, usable component?
Does the final necessary engineering step erase the initial scientific breakthrough?
We'll leave you with that thought for your next deep dive.